The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, some people have been in this business so long that they've seen cycles, but they've also seen secular trends. And what I'd like to do is, before we bring our guest on, have you explain the difference between a cyclical trend and a secular trend so that our listeners can understand what he's saying.
Absolutely. And Ian McCavity has been writing about the markets since 1972, but actually involved in the market since 1961.
Right. So before either one of us were born, I mean, he does have a view that we couldn't possibly have.
Well, I think a particularly unique perspective dealing with natural resources, mainly because Canada, and Toronto specifically, is a real hub for natural resource development, and it's a major contribution to the Canadian gross national product or gross domestic product.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Toronto almost reminds me of the Switzerland of the North American continent, because we have clients right now who do store some of their gold in Switzerland, but Toronto has opened up as well. And, you know, if you look at Toronto, you look at the Toronto Exchange, you look at everything involved in Toronto, and it just oozes of gold.
Yeah, you're right, because as a financial center, it is one of the North American primary financial centers, even more so than San Francisco or Chicago. It's sort of New York, Toronto, and we sometimes forget that, being very American-centric.
Okay, now, secular.
Yeah, the question of secular versus cyclical, really, if you wanted to translate that, primary could be substituted for secular. Secondary could be substituted for cyclical. So your primary trends, your longer-term trends, are what you're calling secular. Your shorter-term, sort of the smaller intermediate trends, are your secondary or cyclical trends. If you want to think of it as this way, when the tide comes in or goes out, that's your primary trend. That's your secular trend. But even in the context of the tide going in or the tide going out, those big primary trends, you also have the waves rolling in or rolling out, and those are your smaller cyclical, happening at the same time, but just with a different importance.
You know, David, your family has been very much into the primary first. In other words, look at the long-term trends. Sometimes those trends will last 25 or 30 years, such as the interest rate cycle or, you know, the gold-Dow ratio, things we've talked about before. The short-term trader, however, the person who's watching and just trying to watch financial TV, whether they're doing it on the internet, what have you, they're playing the cycle. They don't really care what the primary trend is because they're in and out before they actually recognize what that is. Now, with primary trend watching, because actually the person who's listening to this program, for the most part, is a person who's trying to protect the value of their long-term savings. Primary trends, that's where that becomes important.
Yeah, and you've seen the world kind of shrink in terms of its time frame from, as we mentioned last week, managing for a quarter of a century,
right,
down to managing assets for the next quarter. But quite frankly, traders have a fixation with monthly, weekly, daily, hourly, down to the millisecond in terms of what they're interested in, what they're interested in holding, and the rate of turnover in their portfolios. So you can look at that cyclical on a very micro scale. And again, I think for perspective, the long-term investor is going to be well served by identifying the primary trends, those secular trends that last for a long period of time. And that really sets the stage for anything else that may be happening and gives you a better understanding of what those smaller iterations are as they occur. Let's not confuse the small trends with the larger and the bigger picture.
Well, and Ian McCavity has had 50 years experience, so he's not only experienced the long-term secular trends, but he also writes an excellent letter on short-term cyclical moves as well. He's a technician in the market.
That's right. Deliberations on World Events. It's a fabulous publication. Writing deliberations from the 1970s, this is a small community of thinkers, of writers. My dad has been a part of that. The Aiden sisters, you know, Jim Dines, Richard Russell. And again, it's a small community of people who have been thinking and writing and publishing for decades.
Well, David, some of these guys, I like to get inside their heads. You know, I like to listen to what your dad's thoughts are because he's looked carefully for decades. And same thing with Ian McCavity. Like you said, the Aiden sisters, they bring the longer-term perspective to the markets. And, you know, Harry Schultz. Think about how long Harry Schultz wrote his letter. So let's go ahead and go to your conversation with Ian.
In our last conversation, we noted that, Ian, you've been writing deliberations since about 1972. We had gotten into the investment business about that same time, and your reflections have been very prescient through the years with a focus on technical analysis and, of course, not neglecting the fundamentals. But there is a great story to be told in the charts, and there's a number of things we want to look at today, starting with the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500. Let's just begin with this. Other than counterfeiting, what could fuel the market's rise, say, another 15-20% from here?
I don't see the market going much higher from here. I think we're basically in the vicinity of a very significant top. And as far as I'm concerned, the majority of the market really topped out back in 2011. And we've seen higher highs on some U.S. indices since then. But 13 out of 15 world markets that I track have not made higher highs in 2012. And some of the broader indexes in the U.S. have also not made higher highs. So as far as I'm concerned, we're at the top of a cycle within this secular trend that really dates from 2000. And in my view, I think we're going down a lot more than people think.
The volume through the summer months was lackluster. Prices were still on the rise, and maybe that was just levitation, holding out hopes for QE3. But we've had past periods that were somewhat reminiscent of this, 1907, 1987. It feels a little bit like we're venturing onto thin ice with a potential decline. I don't know if it's 15-20%, but, you know, a Dow 11,000, a Dow 10,000, let's talk about what a top would signify if it's a cyclical top in the context of a secular bear market starting in 2000, as you just mentioned. Where could we go from here?
Well, basically, cyclical bears within a secular bear tend to run twice as long as the bear markets that you see in secular uptrend periods, and they also tend to cut a lot deeper. In a lot of the talks that I give, I point out that in the secular bull phases, the average bear is over in about 7 months, and it only falls about 20%. But in the secular sideways or down periods, such as I think we've been in for the past decade, the bear markets tend to run for about 18 months and lose an average of about 32%. That's excluding the distortion caused by 1929 to 32. But I hear people talking about, you know, we're into a cyclical bull market. But I don't think that they grasp the significance of being still within the secular sideways to down period. And I think that's part of the problem that the Fed has. I think the Fed is still thinking that this is somehow cyclical rather than secular. They keep pumping money into the trading desks in New York, basically. And then they're surprised that that money also flows not just to the stock market, but also into the commodity markets and other markets. In the shorter term, I think we've seen a really marked, worrisome disparity showing up just in the old-fashioned Dow theory between the Dow industrials making higher highs and the Dow transports not making higher highs. And in fact, the transports not far from breaking down to really give an extremely negative signal. And people think of the Dow theory as being esoteric, but if you just think of the industrials reflecting the hopes and expectations of the manufacturing process on the one hand, and the transports being the industry that gets those manufacturers to market, you know, there's quite a disparity between the makers of things and the carriers of things going a different direction. I'm very worried about what I see in the transportation sector.
Well, and that's certainly supported with an increase in inventories, channel stuffing as it's often called, where manufacturing has yet to slow, but delivery of product to the end consumer is still failing in support of that. So when we look at the period of 1968 to 1982, we had a period where essentially we had prices capped. It was a bear market, but it wasn't a catastrophic bear, cataclysmic like 1929 to 1932. And yet, if you were looking at real impact to a portfolio, by the time you got to the late 70s and early 80s, because inflation was on the rise, the bite was, could you argue, just as bad as, say, that 1929 to 1932 period?
Basically, if you look at the Dow on an inflation-adjusted basis, it peaked in early 1966 and finally declined in 1982 with an overall decline that probably rivaled 1929 to 32. It may have been a little bit less, but pretty close to it. Again, that's assuming how much confidence you've got in the CPI that you're inflation-adjusting with. My confidence in any data coming out of Washington has been deteriorating at an accelerating pace over the last two decades.
Yeah, to me, it's a little bit like the frog being boiled slowly, or the lobster, frankly, being in the pot. If it happens slow enough, you don't know it's happening to you. And by the time we covered a good 10, 15-year period, people didn't realize just how much money they were losing. There was no impetus for action. contrast that with the 1930s, and there was probably more sensitivity to what was happening in the marketplace. I guess if there's any similarity that I'm drawing to that 66 to 82 period, it is that complacency reigns. How do you feel about that?
Well, very much so. Bear in mind, it was March of 1968 when Lyndon Johnson brought in the so-called Great Society. And, you know, that really was the big turning point to me in post-war America, where he basically said, we're going to have guns and butter and not pay for it. And that was the beginning of the really crazy deficit phase, even though deficits had been there previously. And it was that 1968 guns and butter speech that subsequently led to essentially the French and the Swiss demanding the exchange of their dollars for U.S. gold that led to Nixon closing the gold window in 1971 to go into a complete fiat currency system. And it took several years for that all to unfold. But in many respects, it was that 68 to 71 period that set the stage for the next decade. And there's more than a few similarities today to that period.
Just going back to comments on the Dow and S&P, you could, if we saw prices continue to rise, the potential for a huge double top at the old highs of 14,165 or on the S&P at about 1565 exist. We've had a capped price at about 900 if you're looking at the Russell 2000, and it's perhaps a more dramatic look looking at these two major averages, the S&P and the Dow. Again, going back to the cyclical bear within the context of a secular bear and looking at a massive double top developed over a 2007 to present period, as a chartist, what could you predicate in terms of downside on that basis?
I think we're going to go back and see the March 2009 lows before this is all done. It's not all going to happen in one stage, but to me, they've essentially extended this cycle by about 12 months, dragging it on and on, and we're going to pay for that on the other side, because the more you extend it in the one direction, the laws of physics take over and create the equal but opposite reaction on the other. In my view, the balance of 2012, I think people are way too optimistic, and 2013, 2014, I think are going to be quite challenging. Now, you've got a global slowdown underway that is, in many respects, still accelerating. It was sort of ironic over the weekend to see some data in which they were aghast that Spain's government debt-to-GDP ratio was going to be 90%. I sort of chuckled because that's better than the United States, but the U.S. commentators didn't bother to point that out.
Well, it is a global slowdown we're talking about, and so perhaps with that as a backdrop, we could talk about the election and what, if any, import it is in terms of the global financial markets. You know, if Obama wins, what's the likely direction of the equity market? 6, 12, 24 months. A Romney win, what's the likely direction? Is there much difference in terms of outcome, in your opinion?
Well, frankly, I think just looking at everything I'm seeing in the election, it certainly looks like Obama is going to get reelected. My larger concern is whether Harry Reid continues to control the Senate. And if you've got the same morass that you've been in for the last 2 years, to me, that's the most bearish outcome of all. And I keep hearing people talk about somehow or other in the lame duck period that they're going to, quote unquote, do the right thing and extend the so-called fiscal cliff. But these are the people that created that fiscal cliff. And after the election results, they're all going to hate each other even more. And I think it takes a huge leap of faith to assume that this Congress will do anything intelligent. And the net result is I'm very concerned about the economic shock that is in store for the U.S. economy in the first quarter, because I don't know that they're going to get the so-called fiscal cliff averted. And when I hear them talking about, well, they'll clean it up later and make it retroactive, how is a businessman supposed to plan his business on tax policy that is going to be fixed later retroactively? That's going to paralyze the decision-making process. Even before January 1, if people are going to have to make economic decisions on how they manage their business, for example, whether they're going to have 52 employees or 48 employees, they've got to give notice 30 to 60 to 90 days before that change takes place. And they're talking about fixing something after the election and before Christmas. It's absolutely insane. The political process, to me, has just completely broken down in Washington.
When we look at that 2013 to 2014 period, then it's both a global issue in terms of slowdown as well as a domestic issue. And again, before we move on to broader economic concerns, you know, with limited exceptions, the stock market's been a pretty good indicator of who the victor would be. Looking at some of the studies that have been done there, you just suggested Obama's likely to be the winner Are you looking at something as a basis for that?
Yeah, you know, there's one chart theory, basically, that says whatever the Dow does in the 60 days up to the election will govern who wins the election. And in essence, we closed at 13,091 on the Dow on the 31st of August. And what I've inferred from that is if the Dow's above 13,222, then Obama would be the victor. And if the Dow is below 13,000 or below 12,960, that would be 1% down from the end of August, then Romney would be the winner. It's sort of ironic to watch how we're fighting around that 13,000 level. And I wouldn't be surprised if there aren't a few hidden hands in there trying to make sure that the Dow stays well above 13,000 between now and Election Day. But whenever I see alleged hidden hands in markets, basically they paint red circles on themselves to become targets for traders to shoot for. So I'm very skeptical. I think the market could face some quite serious downside risk coming in before the election, even in spite of the presumption that somehow Bernanke's mandate is to get the market up between now and year end. I'm very skeptical of that.
Well, looking at gold in a broader context, we've talked about the fact that the slowdown, 13 of the 15 stock market indices that you look at globally have not recovered fully. And so, you know, the idea that this is certainly a broader issue leads well into the conversation about gold. We have seen demand for gold on a global basis increasing from the 70s, 80s into the 90s. It used to be a North American and European dominated market in the physical world, and now it is an Indian subcontinent and Asian dominated market. Let's look at how gold fared in other currencies. We've just been through a year-long corrective phase in U.S. dollar terms, but again, for the international gold investor, what's the view from there?
Well, for starters, it's already made a new high against the euro, which would be the other critical one. Bear in mind that, in essence, when you look at global foreign exchange reserves as declared, they're about 60-some percent in dollars and about 27% denominated in euros. So it's gold against the dollar and gold against euro that matters most. And you've already made a new high against the euro on this recent round, and we're currently fighting with the 1,800 level and that prior peak at 1,900 in dollar terms. But in my view, you've now got the 50-day moving average having made the golden cross back up through the 200-day moving average that says we've now started the sixth leg of this upcycle in gold that dates back to 2001. We've completed the correction.
Maybe you can fill out some of the details on what a golden cross is. 50-day moving average, crossing the 200-day moving average, a technical buy signal, is that correct?
It's not so much a buy signal so much as it's a lagging trend confirmation signal that the major trend has changed back up. Again, when you're in a secular uptrend, as the gold price has been, it's not the sort of thing that the day it happens, it becomes a buy signal, because you would have already seen it in an assortment of shorter term moving averages. But the history of the gold 50 to 200 ratio has been very strong and with very, very few false starts. That's one of the reasons why I pay as much attention to it as I do. And in my view, at this point, you've now got the 50-day moving average rising at a faster rate than the 200-day. And the 50 crossed up through the 200 about a week ago to confirm that this little breakout of the downtrend line of the last few months, this little breakout is real. We've tested the 1550 to 1625 area three or four times over the past year, and we're now going in the other direction to try and confirm a breakout by getting through 1,800. Go through 1,800, go through 1,900. Those are the two upside thresholds. And then basically it's Katie bar the door for a couple of $100 move beyond that. That's been the nature of this cycle when you look at the charts on a logarithmic scale, because, you know, you've got to think of it in percentage terms or semi-log scale type terms. And in my view, I think there's still a good possibility we see something like 2,200 or 2,300 before the end of this year. We're in the fourth quarter of the year already. I think we're that close to a significant change in character.
We have an interesting mirror then, because on the one hand, you've got a cyclical bear emerging in the equity market in the context of a larger secular bear market. The flip side is, within the gold space, a secular bull market and now a cyclical upturn within that larger context. Now, one of the comments that you made earlier was that the downturns, cyclical bear markets, in the context of a secular bear market, tend to be exaggerated. Is there any similar characteristic in terms of the opposite?
In the secular uptrend that gold is in, the corrections tend to be short and sweet. You know, you'll get sharp volatility, but they tend to be over pretty quickly. The correction that we've just had, for example, ran for a year. And then I would expect it to run a minimum 12 to 18, possibly 24 months on the high side, depending on the nature of the advance. If it's an orderly advance, like it's going up a staircase, that becomes a sustainable rate of trend, as opposed to something that makes moonshot kind of moves where it sort of spurts up 100 and then gives back 50, then up 100 or up 200, that kind of thing. That becomes less sustainable. I'm expecting to see a fairly orderly stair-step movement, pretty much as we saw on the last cycle. Once we broke through the 1050 level, it was a pretty orderly progression up to 1450. It got a little more accelerated after that, but I'm looking for that sort of more orderly kind of an advance initially. Every time I hear people talk about this is some sort of a top in gold or that the gold rush is over, I just burst out laughing because they haven't even seen the beginning of a gold rush. I speak at conferences all over the place, and you ask people, and they all want to talk about gold, then you ask them how many own it, and about 10%, 5% of the hands go up. You know, at the end of the day, they'll be beating down the door to get more of it.
When you look at year-end, potentially being 22, 2300, what is that slate of 2013, 2014 to look like on an orderly basis? Again, not a rate of change exceeding 100, 150%, but again, sort of the stair step that you were describing.
I don't know that I'd want to put a percentage term on it, but you're probably going to see something in the order of 10, 12%. I'm trying to look at the relative level of debt creation around the world and similarly the patience levels of the major holders of fiat paper. And those major holders, I think, increasingly are going to actually end up calling the tune. China by itself has got in excess of $3 trillion worth of paper. Russia's got $500 billion, India's got $300 billion, Taiwan's got $400 billion, Saudi Arabia's got $600 billion. That's a lot of billions, and they don't own a great deal of gold. I made the comment much earlier on about the present period being comparable to 1971. As these emerging countries that have accumulated these extensive foreign exchange reserves, as they watch the ECB, the Bank of England, and the Fed, is layering debt on top of debt on top of debt. They're just basically debauching the purchasing power of the paper that they hold. And at one point, there's going to be a disagreement where China is basically going to end up saying, okay, we've had enough. There's going to be some policy move, whether it's over the islands in the South China Sea, I don't know. Whether Israel does something to Iran, it's a risk that worries me, and the alienation of the entire Arab world or the Muslim world concerns me, that we may see higher oil prices, not driven by demand for oil, but driven by concern for the credibility of the dollar, because that's what really was attacked in 1971. And I think we're coming into a period that could be likened to that, and it will be the external holders of those dollars that basically call the tune. And they basically will be saying, okay, we've had enough, we're going to convert our dollars into gold. And not just gold, copper, tangible assets around the world. China's been doing a lot of that, I would say, on a quiet basis rather than on a provocative basis, because they don't want to provoke Congress into going protectionist. But we know that in periods of serious economic distress, then protectionism naturally rises in all of the industrialized countries. And nobody wins if you go protectionist, because then global trade contracts at an even greater rate. The foreign holders of paper are the ones that are going to call the tune.
And the proof is certainly in the foreign exchange reserve holdings, where your developed world countries own a lot of gold already, but don't have a lot in terms of foreign exchange reserves that is new and just sitting there in fiat currency. The emerging markets, on the other hand, have on average about 4% of an allocation to gold, and have plenty of buying power in terms of liquid capital. As you mentioned, the Chinese at the top of the heap with close to $3 trillion.
Yeah, I publish a table that I refer to in a lot of my talks of the 15 emerging countries. And one of the points to illustrate on that is collectively they've got about $7 trillion of paper that's largely denominated in dollars and euro. A key point to that is that that number has doubled since all of the bailouts started in 2007. So they've created all these trillions of pieces of paper. Somehow or other, close to $4 trillion of it has ended up in the hands of these emerging countries. They think it's an asset. They're carrying it on their books as an asset. But if the Federal Reserve, the ECB, and the Bank of England are deliberately undermining its purchasing power, they're going to come to a point where they're going to say, we'd rather own something else.
We've certainly seen a lot of central bank buying going back to 2009, sort of the pre-2009 period, being net liquidations, the characteristic of central bank activity in the gold space, and from that point forward, net purchases they're adding to. We are seeing this happen already.
It has been happening. The most dramatic of all was the IMF auction back in 2009, where the IMF finally got the approval of various members to auction off or to sell 400 tons of gold. And the Indians stepped right up and bought 200 tons of it at the equivalent of $1,045 an ounce. The reason I remember that number so well is it coincided with a headline in Barron's saying that gold was still a lousy investment. And I published a chart showing that gold had just broken through 1,000. It was the most exciting moment you could ask for, and Barron's had this negative headline. But it was the Indian purchase of 200 tons. And then the IMF, I'm aware that they were approached by some private investors about buying the other 200 tons, and they were terrified of the idea of being seen to sell it to private investors. So instead, they leaked it into the market in smaller installments later. And one of the ironies of that particular IMF auction, this past weekend, the IMF finally has come out with a comment that they're going to allocate up to $1 billion of those proceeds to help out the third world countries or something. And they refer to the money as being the windfall gain that they made on their gold.
At 1,045.
Yeah, them by selling it at 1,045.
That's like the British talking about windfall from unlocking a dead asset at $252 or $260 an ounce.
The so-called brown bottom in gold back in 1999 to 2001.
Well, there's been massive interest in gold ETFs. I mean, the rate of increase in interest there, we're nearing peaks, if not new peaks, in the consumption of gold via ETFs. Is that because many in the investor community are concerned about COMEX behavior and the results of MF Global? They don't want a leveraged contract position?
I think that that's been a very big part of it. The MF Global and then the failure of the PFG Best, and there was another one, the Sentinel fiasco from a couple of years earlier. I think COMEX has severely damaged its credibility. You know, the commingling of client funds with house assets for their own trading accounts, that scared a lot of serious money away from COMEX. I used to tell people on a regular basis that you own COMEX contracts and fully secure them with treasury bills so that you can collect interest on it if you're a large enough account. And that became the easiest and cheapest way to own gold. But the way things have unfolded, COMEX and the CFTC in recent years, I think you'd be crazy to leave it in the hands of a CFTC-registered firm or COMEX firm. And that's really what's led to, I think, the evolution of the ETFs. You know, with Central Fund of Canada back in 1983, we created the original stock exchange tradable bullion proxy that for most of that history, it was a physical mix of 50 ounces of silver for each 1 ounce of gold. And then in the later years, we also created Central Gold Trust, which was gold only, and they both trade on the New York Stock Exchange. But the distinction there was that they're Canadian entities, which could qualify them for capital gains tax treatment under some of the U.S. tax law, which became an attractor. But subsequently, with the velocity of trading, the trading liquidity of GLD and IAU is such that a great many of the young, aggressive managers today just want to trade those instruments that have the greatest trading liquidity. And you've now basically got computers that are robo-trading in the GLD. That's where a lot of its volume comes from. But at the same time, if you want to commit a substantial amount of money into gold with having a minimal market impact, GLD has been the way for traders to go. And they've also got apparently very active options markets going in it as well. So GLD has become a marvelous trading mechanism for those who want to trade gold. I'm not convinced it's the best way to hold gold for a longer period of time because I think their costs are too high. But from a trader point of view, there's no question that the ETFs have attracted a significant flow of gold.
Well, let's make sure and not neglect silver in this conversation, because clearly when you go back to CEF and the original component parts, a 50-to-1 allocation, 50 ounces of silver to 1 ounce of gold, what you've done is basically open the conversation to what the ratio is currently, which is right on 50-to-1. It's been higher than that in a range of 60-to-100 and even lower in the last 18 to 24 months, reaching a low of about 31-to-1. What does the course ahead look like? And how would you look at silver as an addition to a metals portfolio? You know, it's not 60 or 70 to 1. Should it not be paid attention to at these levels? Or with history in mind, how would you frame the context?
Well, I've done a lot of historical work on the silver-gold ratio because, in essence, when you've got a heated-up gold market, then silver becomes gold on steroids. People revert to its monetary history, even though it doesn't really have an official monetary role any longer. But I still think of it, it trades on its monetary history. And in essence, from 1984 to last year, it had been locked in a broad range that was, I would say, roughly 45 to 1 to 1. Silver was rich relative to gold, and anything over 80 to 1, silver was cheap relative to gold. And on that run to $50 that we had back in 2011, on that run, it got to about 30 to 1 on the futures. And in my view, as a technician, that breakout occurred at around the 60 to 1 level. So I've been working on the hypothesis that last year's move probably broke it out of that old 45 to 80 range and may have set up a new range going forward at which we may see 30 to 1 as an extreme where silver's ahead of gold or 60 to 1 where silver is cheap relative to gold. And on the recent correction period when the prices were lower, we were in the 55, 56 area, which is where I started to really feel that the 55 to 60 ratio was going to be a good opportunity entry level for the silver market. And if you go back prior to 1984, when silver gold was 45 to 1, silver was cheap relative to gold, and at the extremes, it was as little as 15 to 1. Now, Eric Sprott, who's been a promoter of a couple of the large new ETFs in recent years, keeps talking about going back to 15 to 1. I'm sort of not anxious to see that happen because when it's happened in the past, it's been very sharp and very brief. And again, I'm not a big fan of looking for moonshot kinds of things that might be the end of a cycle kind of move. But I would recognize that it's entirely possible you may see 15 to 1 at some point in the much later stages of this cycle. But for now, I'm working on a practical range of 60 to 1, silver is cheap, 30 to 1, silver is probably a little rich.
Well, David, I love the concept that Ian McCavity's talking about because it's something we've used here for decades. It's what we call compounding ounces. And of course, what that means is when silver is favored over gold, you go a little bit more silver. And then when that silver does its thing relative to gold, you go a little bit more gold. And over time, without having to add any new paper money, you've got an ounce by ounce gain in the portfolio. It compounds the ounces.
There's a certain degree of pragmatism and positivity that you bring into a precious metals portfolio, not just a question of we own gold because it's a fear play. We favor the value play.
Right.
And that's really what you're looking at in the ratio between gold and silver. You're always favoring the ratio. We're making sure that you recognize it. Even if you have greater preference for gold as the dominant position in your portfolio, you should recognize the value and certainly participate at that level.
Well, David, this is not just an application to gold and silver. You can use this ratio with gold and real estate. You can use the ratio with gold and whatever you want to do. In fact, the Dow to gold ratio has been an incredibly helpful tool as to know when to stock up on the gold, let it grow, but then also exercise an exit strategy for some of that gold when it hits the right ratio.
Sure. Secular trends are not necessarily predicated simply on price. It is a relationship to other assets, and that's where that's particularly helpful. We'll include that in our conversation with Ian McCavity next week as he joins us again on the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Ian McCavity. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.